Welcome to this Innovation Forum podcast with me, Ian Welsh. I'm delighted that joining me today are Amanda Archila, Executive Director of Fairtrade America, and Anna Mann, Associate Director for Responsible Business for the Fairtrade Foundation. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
We're going to be talking a bit about the work of fair trade, pricing in commodity supply chains, and also a bit about what the future looks like. It feels like pricing across many value chains is under pressure right now. To what extent do you think there's a significant gap between price and value? Amanda?
Pricing has certainly long been disconnected from the value of products that we work in at Fairtrade, like coffee, cocoa, bananas. This sort of restless search for ever cheaper prices has pretty systemically overlooked the people and communities, folks who depend on them. And this race for quickest profits has really turned the trade of products into a much bigger game of chance. And the highest earnings tend to go to people that are much further down the supply chain than those farmers and workers. What are the drivers of that? Certainly one of the biggest is the imbalance of power in trading negotiations that we've seen for generations in a lot of these commodities, and a real failure to consider critical costs, costs of sustainable production, an insufficient risk assessment of economic, social, environmental considerations. You know, and you mentioned kind of pricing pressures off the top. And if you look at the root cause of some of those pressure points, whether it be inputs, whether it be logistics and supply chain, whether it be packaging, a lot of those are driven by a long-term failure to capture some of those economic, social, and environmental challenges, whether that be on labor costs, whether that be on climate change and climate resilience. And so we really have to come together and recognize that those costs simply have not been factored in for quite some time. The current system of commodity trade just really isn't built in a way that honors that labor, that expertise, those production inputs of smallholder farmers. And interestingly, we're actually seeing at this very moment a particularly notable example of the inevitable buildup that happens when we undervalue, and that's in cocoa pricing. So you see this drastic increase in price in the cocoa sector, certainly exacerbated by a lot of this additional market activity we're seeing, but the root cause primarily driven by a drop in supply, which is triggered by crop loss due to disease, climate change, long-time increase in cost of productions, and the impact of crippling inflation on farmers themselves. So those years, decades, generations of undervaluing and underinvesting in cocoa farmers has led to this. So that's a particularly prime example of how differentiated value and price has been for quite some time and the real impacts that we are now facing across society.
Thank you. It's inevitable, perhaps, when you have the wrong incentives in the value chain that don't, in this instance, allow for or promote the long-term investment that is obviously necessary. Anna, do you have anything to add to that point?
It is really acute at the moment. What's happening in the cocoa market has really brought that to life, but it's true across so many of the products that we work with that inflation is a global phenomenon and it's incredibly high, and it has been high for a few years, particularly thinking about producers coming out of COVID and the additional costs that they faced during COVID-19 in terms of labor and additional inputs, and so many supply chains broke down at that time. Then into global inflation driven by lots of the geopolitical events that we've seen. And on top of that is climate change. And yet, whilst obviously there are kind of inflation associated with products that we buy, the disconnect between the cost of production and what a shopper will pay for a product is really, really stark. And I think this problem with undervaluing is only going to make all of the current challenges so much worse into the future.
So Anna, what constitutes a fair price then?
For a price to be considered fair, there are so many factors at play on what it takes to ensure value back for a farmer who's worked so hard to produce the products that we rely on. From a fair trade perspective, we obviously have the fair trade minimum price, and we calculate this on cost of production, and we look at what are the cost of inputs, what's the local economic environment for a farmer, what are the costs of trade associated with that product, and cost of export. Shipping can substantially shift the cost associated with purchasing a product. Even though that's about fair trade's heartland and we really talk about the minimum price, it is a minimum. It's what we would consider a floor of a price that should be paid to a farmer. And often it is what we call active because the market price is low, which is really concerning when you think about what that means for a farmer just to cover their cost of production. And then the other key piece for fair trade is thinking beyond what's the minimum and into what should be fair. And for us, we think fair is what enables a farmer to earn what we call a living income. So enough to feed their family, to be able to save, to send their children to school. And in the case of hired labor, a living wage, which is very similar in terms of being able to save and also cover your costs. And that's even further away from the pricing we see.
Amanda, anything to add on what constitutes fair price?
A fair price is one where producers aren't just paid to cover their costs, but they're actually given the opportunity to enjoy secure and sustainable livelihoods. And that's really what Anna is speaking to, right? It's not just this transactional piece. It's really about an opportunity for a sustainable future. I think inevitably, this means that both buyers and sellers, so in our case, right, farmers and workers, have to have an equal voice in putting a value on their own livelihoods and choices for their futures. So those costs of sustainable production that Anna's mentioning, right, all of those factors have to come from a calculation not just done right at one end of the supply chain, but really agreed to and assessed appropriately by all actors and by those who are most impacted. So in fair trade, we have 50% producer representation and voice in decision making on fair trade minimum price and premium. And so that fairness comes as much from the process of this decision making as it does from the final outcome. So there has to be equity in the decision making. A lot of folks love to get into the debate with fair trade around, well, the supply demand curve will just sort of work this out, right? That's the best way to come up with a fair price. But we all know that the conditions for that sort of dream state of supply and demand definitely aren't being met currently. And we are very, very far away from that, where both parties have equal access to information, equal access to negotiating power. That's just really not the case. Having these benchmarks in play, whether it's a minimum price, whether it's a living income reference price, are really, really critical to make sure that the voices of producers are heard and that the risks of that impower of balance is really assessed and considered.
Thinking about fair pricing, and I think where the market is going as well, is that it's also no longer about cost of production today, but it is about cost of production tomorrow. And I think thinking about fairness in the supply chain, we've seen this so much that if farmers aren't paid enough to cover the cost of sustainable production, but also to be able to adapt to climate change and mitigate those risks and think about diversification at farm level, then it's not even just a case of a fair price, it's what's the future price. And I think this is probably where the market needs to start waking up a little bit with the shortages and volatility we've seen when thinking about what is fair pricing as well.
Absolutely. And that links entirely back to the point we made earlier around cocoa supply chain. You need to be thinking now in terms of the investment that's required for future cocoa buyers as well as cocoa buying right now. Amanda, perhaps we can go into this a little bit more detail. What are the root causes then of unfair pricing from the producer's perspective?
We touched on this a little bit already. Certainly this imbalance of power and systemic inequality has resulted in a lot of the unfair trading practices and trading structures that have been placed in commodity trading for many, many years. And it's resulted in this chronic underpayment of farming communities who grow these crops. Other factors exacerbate that, right? Global inflation, those input costs. For example, in Cote d'Ivoire, the average US dollar price of fertilizer, the major driving cost of inputs, applied in cocoa production went up by 57% since 2018. We talk a lot about inflation and the impact that it has on end consumers, the impact that it has on manufacturers, but then we sometimes forget the impact that this inflation has on the actual production and the actual livelihoods of the producers themselves. And that's really, really critical. Climate change certainly, and the cost of investing in climate resiliency and then adapting to the regulation, that's a piece of that. And I know we'll talk a little bit more about that and who bears that cost, and farmers bearing that burden also exacerbates the pricing challenges that farmers have faced over the years. And on that climate piece, I mean, we know that by 2050, 50% of existing coffee land will no longer be suitable for production. This isn't just a question of, are we helping out coffee farmers or cocoa farmers? Are we doing the right thing? This is a question about whether or not there will be a future industry at all for these commodities. There has to be a collective reckoning around the prices we've been paying for decades to producers without factoring in all of these risks, including risks around aging farmers as younger generations refuse to participate in an industry that keeps them in poverty, unsustainable growing practices, the collective wake-up call we're seeing that's demanding that industries treat their suppliers with dignity and regulating that accordingly. So we have to recognize that we must pay more to producers to maintain a future for these industries.
Yes, it's interesting that for many of these farmers, success for them is their children not being farmers. I mean, they actually actively are promoting their children doing other things and wanting them to get out of the industry. And it does always strike me that the root cause of all these problems is the commoditization of these products. The fact that that's how the markets have developed disincentivizes the long-term future proofing that is so necessary and becoming very apparent in both cocoa and coffee.
Absolutely.
So Anna, how can the costs be shared along value chains to reflect the actual value of that part of the chain?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few ways that this can happen, depending on the business and the size of the business that they have. From a fair trade perspective, the way that we publish our minimum prices, but also reference prices for either incomes or wage-based interventions is totally public, transparent, exists for any business as a reference, and is based on the rigorous methodology that Amanda's already spoken through. And then on top of that, from the fair trade side, we have the additional fair trade premium. And that is an absolute critical support to farmers to be able to invest in a lot of the interventions that we've spoken about today in terms of climate change resilience, adaptation, sustainable agriculture. There are still further companies can go, though. Those interventions work at their best through transparent or traceable supply chains. So knowing where you buy from and committing to them in the long term is so important. Really, minimum price that varies year on year and there's no guarantee for the next season doesn't mean very much. Farmers need to know what they're going to earn for every harvest going forward to be able to make those investment plans and being sustainable and resilient. And I think for businesses that are struggling to find their voice, that they're not maybe big enough or got the power enough to necessarily drive change for the volumes they buy. From the UK perspective, we are piloting an initiative that we call Shared Impact that we worked with the Competition and Markets Authority as well. And the idea is to bring together who are relatively small buyers of products into a buying pool, give them the leverage to make a difference at farmer level, and then make sure the minimum price and premium is passed through to individual farmers over the long term. And I think, you know, these are relatively straightforward activities a business can take to make sure farmers are benefiting in the long run.
So are long-term contracts part of a fair trade arrangement?
From the fair trade perspective, in the standards that we have, there are procurement terms and how that works in terms of payment terms and planning up front. But the idea of a 3 to 5 year contract, that is something that businesses need to be prepared to make on their own terms. And I think from what we've seen from the fair trade perspective, if you combine a long-term contract of 3 to 5 years of sales, you give the price protection of the fair trade minimum price, and then you bring that fair trade additional premium in, the difference that makes is phenomenal. A cocoa farmer isn't going to reinvest in new crops on their land or agroforestry or shade trees or diversification if they spent all of their money once and didn't get it again. And so it really is combining those economic interventions of price and premium with that long-term security that you can really drive forward meaningful impact on the ground.
Is there almost an irony in that the potential supply shocks that we've been discussing, might they then mean they're more likely to get long-term arrangement because buyers are now desperate to ensure they do get the supply that they require?
If there's one thing the current market volatility has shown is that, yes, it is poor business practice to not invest in farmers, that you stand to massively lose by not building true partnerships with farmers over the long term. But the market has historically been very quick to forget. It often runs in a boom and bust cycle. Typically, lots of businesses rely on natural corrections in that typically supply will increase as prices incentivize more farmers to come into the sector. They will have more supply again. And I think our worry is with climate change and upcoming legislation and massive shifts in the market, the cost of production is just no longer the same, and those cycles will no longer be able to work in the same way. Land is becoming unviable for production. And I think we worry that whilst it should move to long-term contracts with a price intervention and additional support to farmers, if the market doesn't do that, they will realise too late that that's what they needed to do at this point.
Whilst there may not be regulation coming in terms of long-term contracts or length of contract, there is a lot of regulation that's on the books and coming in through this year and coming months that will have significant impact on all of this. What are the solutions that can help farmers, and particularly smallholder farmers, comply with the new regulation, the EU deforestation regulation, due diligence, all the rest of it? Anna?
I think it's worth reflecting on just what a big ask a lot of these legislations are for smallholder farmers, and that there is considerable additional investment required in meeting those legislations, and that we are talking about supply chains, whereas we've reflected on at the start of this podcast, these farmers have struggled to access the true value of their product for a really long time. The average cocoa farmer lives on less than a dollar a day. And now we're looking at legislation that will change their market access. They will either be able to trade into the EU or they will not, on the basis of whether they can prove compliance with quite stringent legislation, particularly thinking about deforestation. Cocoa cooperatives have memberships of individual farmers, where those individual farmers are based, whether they have engaged in deforestation, whether they're a member of one or two cooperatives, whether that cooperative has a system to be able to track membership, let alone geolocations and polygon mapping. This is all very big asks of farmers whose primary business is trading cocoa. And so I think what we see is that there is a very real risk that if the supply chains don't stand together with those farmers and invest in them, there'll be one of two outcomes. One is they won't be able to trade to the market anymore. They will have lost EU access. They can't prove they're deforestation free, for example. Or the second is that they will invest everything they have in meeting compliance and new monitoring systems, technology systems, first mile traceability between farmer and cooperative, satellite monitoring. But at what cost? To what other interventions? To what other expenditure did they have? And I think from a fair trade perspective, we're really working through the price and the premium and what they can do to support this. We have our own partnerships and our own standards. But outside of fair trade, it is a very important ask to businesses that they really, really work with smallholder farmers to support them towards this compliance.
And again, maybe there will be a market driver here that will mean that where you have examples of commodities, cocoa being a great example, it does come from smallholder farmers and they tend to be located in Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire. Maybe the market will have no choice but to help those farmers comply with this regulation. In that respect, drive the sector forward.
You'd hope so, but they also have the choice to move volumes elsewhere, particularly if prices are very high at the moment from that region. They also have the choice to shift to what looks like easy compliance, which might be some of the producer groups who have potentially more funds to invest in improving compliance. They might move to a traceable supply chain, for example, which could be great, but who was potentially left behind from that? So there are options available to them, unfortunately, other than really doubling down and investing in the farmers that need it the most. But our hope is, and a big part of the petitions and campaigning we're doing at Fair Trade on this, is to make sure that there is a promise of support to farmers to help them through this.
Ultimately, I guess all of this is going to impact on consumers, because if we don't have our cups of coffee or bars of chocolate, consumers may well end up driving change here. Amanda, I wonder, from fair trade's perspective, it's all about the price really, isn't it? And that's as far as the consumer sees, they see the premium price. How does fair trade support consumers to understand the value of products beyond simply the price?
I would open with challenging a little bit of the notion, particularly around the idea that paying a few cents more per cup of coffee or per pound to farmers and producers inevitably would result in some dramatic increase in price to consumers, right? We know through extensive studies across product types that usually the raw input of cocoa or coffee usually makes up some kind of single digit percentage of the final value of the product. I think collectively, and certainly industry, should challenge this assumption that they can't reimagine their cost structure at all to minimize risks to both producers and impacts on pricing to end consumers. There's a lot of brilliant people inside the biggest food and beverage companies in the world that I have real confidence can absorb some of these costs that are really necessary for the future of the industry without impacting consumers. I always try to leave that note in there because I think we fall under this assumption that by paying farmers a rate that gives them a sustainable livelihood, that inevitably has to go straight into the consumer's wallet. The reality is, though, is that even if consumers do have to pay more, we don't have an option to wait anymore, right? We see it in the headlines around the cost of your Easter chocolate bunny. We see it in changing coffee landscapes. We see it in a lot of the outdated and unrealistic pricing notions for bananas. So collectively, as consumers, manufacturers, producers, right, we've got to adjust these expectations. I don't think we should underestimate consumers' ability to understand these issues, particularly when the alternative, i.e. severe constraints on being able to get a cup of coffee or buy that chocolate Easter bunny, is way worse. You know, there's this headline recently, Trader Joe's upped its banana price from 19 cents to 23 cents after keeping that price the same for over 20 years. And you can imagine the cost to farmers that have changed over the last 20 years for banana production. You know, yes, some Trader Joe's loyalists kind of balked, like, oh my gosh, 4 cents more. But most people's reaction is like, yeah, 23 cents, sure, that seems reasonable. We do our own third-party studies via partnership with GlobeScan, and we see consistently that 67% of fair trade shoppers are willing to pay more, 35 to 66% more, depending on the product. We do our best to really support those brands to understand the impact and communicate this to their consumers. We increased our coffee minimum price in 2023 and made sure that we were explaining in detail to both commercial partners and consumers that, hey, these costs of inputs for coffee production, the risk of climate change are really critical to making sure that you have access to a good cup of coffee in the future. Back to that study with values alignment, fair trade customers and not all customers in 2023 listed inflation as the number one challenge to address. But issues number two and three were poverty and economic injustice and climate change. So if companies lead with these values, educate consumers in a way that demonstrates with transparency and integrity that the sustainable future of these products we all love requires investments in farmers and workers and not deeper pockets to those turning a profit, I think we can all have hope for a brighter, fairer planet.
And I guess the fact that so many consumers now accept that climate change is something that we're all in together, as it were, they can see the impacts on themselves. So it's an easy story to talk about the impacts on the growers of the products that they love.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Anna, any more to add on that?
The other piece is not that we should just estimate how much consumers, like how much they can understand around this, but also how much they want it. There is such a high expectation now on businesses to do the right thing. Shoppers really want to know that when they go and purchase a product, they are doing it with a company that has made the right decisions, that have made fair prices. And Amanda's spoken to a lot of evidence we've collected. And I think it's really visible now to any business working in this space that they need to provide a very credible claim to their shopper on what they are doing to support the farmers and workers behind that supply chain. And with things in the UK, like the Green Claims Code from the CMA, they have to be able to back that up. And there is so much evidence out there now on needing kind of credible, meaningful, evidence-based claims that shoppers want to quickly be able to refer to. So I think it's also a real business case for businesses in doing this from a shopper perspective, because that's what the market really wants to see as well.
And going forward, do you think this is something that increasingly there'll be less resistance from business?
I think the market is changing. I think businesses are beginning to realize that from kind of a future profit perspective, they do need to be making certain investments now. I also think that there are just more and more cases of companies being called out for misleading claims and shoppers walking away from them on that ground, or on the grounds that they think that company is doing the wrong thing and that they do want to be able to spend their money in a responsible way. And they are, as an average shopper, looking for the company to do a lot of the hard work for them. So I think the business case is there now. And I think companies are beginning to shift. Whether they can do it fast enough and whether they can do it with enough investment, I think that's a key question still to be answered.
Absolutely. There are lots of big challenges out there, but there are some exciting emerging solutions that can provide answers. Amanda Archila and Anna Mann from Fairtrade, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ian.